to make sure it's working. It's making a funny noise, but it's recording.
What, that little zip every once in a while?
Yeah.
What I think that is the radar over to Dew Line. Every time it goes around, get a little zip.
And this will pick that up?
Well, sometimes a radio, a little radio I have up there, does. And when Marnie and I, when we were out here in 77 to 79, living right over here in a Quonset hut, we noticed it on the radio because that's all there was, and there was even no TV, and the radio would do that.
Huh.
And some of the instruments that I used down at the RF Scientific Instruments would pick it up also. And it's the only thing I could ever figure out.
How does Dan and Malcolm, how do they deal with it with their equipment?
I don't know. Maybe they don't hear it. I don't know.
That's weird. Yeah, okay. Well, if that's what that is.
At least that's what I've always figured it was. It's the only big radio wave type thing around here that I know of that's probably intermittent but very regular.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, I thought it was a tape recorder, but it's recording, and it's just, it's just an annoying interference.
I think that's what it is. Anyway, I forgot what I was going to say.
Uh-oh.
It takes care of that. I forget what it was. Yeah. Anyway.
It was called Another Harry Story. Talking about how people don't acknowledge him. What he's done.
Oh, I know what I was going to say. Is, you know, when we were looking for information about the design of the whale counting thing, there was, you know, why go to somebody like Harry and pay attention to what he said? And justification I give for that, like in 1981, why did I turn to Harry and begin and believe a lot of the things that he said, which didn't make a whole lot of sense at the time, from conventional scientific wisdom. Lots of whales under the ice, breaking through the ice, not afraid of the ice. These were all things that just were counter to what, you know, most scientific people thought. The reason I felt it was justifiable to virtually accept everything he said without much question, or at least suitable for design experiments around, was because everything else the guy had ever told me in the previous 2 years that I could check on was true. And that was mostly stuff about marmots, you know, while I was out here working for the Navy. And other animals, what he told me about foxes and so on. Almost anything he told me that I could somehow check on seemed like it was true. So that when this crunch came in 98, 81, and 82, that is, what are you going to do about whale counting? It seemed reasonable to go to Harry, and when he said things that themselves didn't seem outwardly easy to believe, my past experience with him led me to believe that even though it doesn't seem too clear to me, it may well be true. Mm-hmm. So it's worth taking a chance on. And that's, I think, that was an important thing. Anyway, I'm sure I'll think of other things later, but Harry was, another thing that struck me about Harry was he was proud of his kids and his family. He was, seemed proud to have worked at Narl. He's well regarded by the Narl people. Great. I mean, I don't think I ever heard anybody say anything bad about the guy. I think he built his own house. His house, I think, is essentially made out of scrap wood from Narl, packing crates and stuff like that. I think he built the whole thing. And I don't know what else to tell you.
Okay. Well, So he was a carpenter, but he ended up helping guide people and do take care of the animals and stuff? Just because he knew things?
I don't think he was involved in taking care of the animals. His job here at Gnarl was as a carpenter.
Okay.
I think he was like called a senior carpenter or something like that, or woodworker or something like that. He worked in the carpentry shop. And he was very skilled in that. But that was his job. I think he also was involved in the Gnarl days of going out with scientists out into the field occasionally, Tanaktuwik Pass or Peter's Lake or something like that. He may have done some of that. I assume he did. I know he went out to some of these places to build the so-called Gnarl huts that are used to be scattered around the North Slope, every village, and out on certain rivers, and at Peter's Lake, and Anaktuwik Pass, and Cape
Sabine.
No, whatever has the radar thing on it. Forget. But there were these. You know what these little Gnarl huts look like around here?
There's one out at Teshupuk. I've seen a picture of it.
Okay, it's called them Wanigans. And I never knew where one. You see this little yellow building,
uh-huh.
This box-like
right.
Between here and the big blue building?
Yeah.
Okay, that is a typical little
gnarl-like
building. And
is it like 8x8 or something?
Well, yeah, they're different sizes, but, you know, 8x12 or something like that. It's sort of like a one-room little thing and that, you know, scientists could hide out in or work in. And he built a number of them, I'm probably at least 20 of them, around the North Slope in various places. And the one that's out at Teshupuk, I'm sure he built, I think he built them all.
Yeah, I mean, he's talked about being at Peter's Lake.
Yeah.
So.
Now, another thing he told me one time, and I'm pretty sure I got this right, is that he went with a geologist long time ago, and they walked from Peter's Lake to Point Hope, I think it was. They walked the whole length of the Brooks Range in Alaska. They went on some kind of an expedition. I forget what it was.
Yeah, he talked about that a lot, and I thought it was Navy, and I think Eugene yesterday said it was maybe Arctic Contractors, which was maybe same as Navy. It was in the 40s.
I don't know who it would be with.
And it was the way I understood it, if it's the same thing, surveying from demarcation all the way to Point Hope.
It could be. But it was, as I remember, it was kind of in the context of something geologic.
Huh.
And but nevertheless, he was along helping whoever this was as a guide and a interpreter and a... keep the other guys from getting killed, falling down, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Well, I certainly could sit and talk to you for hours about this, but I know you have other things to do.
One of the things you got to keep in mind about a measure of a guy like that is what has his offspring done. If you look around in this community, I don't think there are very many parents that can point to as successful a children as Harry and Annie Brower. His kids, by and large, have been very successful, are by and large real nice folks, and I don't think there are very many parents that can say that. Here's one of these little kids right there. Talking about your father. What are you?
Who?
Hi, Sibby.
Your daddy.
Hi, my friend.
What's this? This is the latest, huh? All right. Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
Talking about your dad.
What?
You guys want to talk about your dad?
Harry, if you're gonna Okay. You mentioned table one in here somewhere?
No.
Okay, that's all
okay,
I got.
Yeah, Karen. I just want to do the end that we're finished now. And,
okay.
Thank you very much for your time. I know you're busy.
Well, I don't mind a bit. And if you want to go over any more of this or whatever any time, that'd be okay with me.
Okay. Okay, today is November 16th, 1995, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm speaking with Dr. Tom Albert in his office at NARL in Barrow, and I'm going to be talking to him about Harry Brower Sr. and his recollections of him. Maybe first, before we start, Tom, I should check that release form situation is something we can work out and you're willing to be making this tape.
Yes, I got the fax that you sent, and I'll sign this thing for you.
Okay. We can do it afterwards. I just didn't want to start recording if there was a problem.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Well, I kind of already explained to you a little bit of what I'm doing and why. So I guess I'll just sort of start with, how you knew Harry when you first met him.
Okay. I think I first met Harry in, I think it was in the winter of either 1975 or 1976. And let's say 1976. Actually, it was probably 75, as a matter of fact. But anyway, that's why I was still at the University of Maryland, and I was working, doing a research project for the Office of Naval Research. And they had asked if I wanted to come up here to be a visiting scientist for a year while on sabbatical leave. And I said, yeah, I probably would, but I needed to see the place first. So I came up for a few days, maybe a week or so. And it just so happened that one of the people here at NARL at the time, a lady by the name of Vivian Ames, who actually she took me into church on Sunday, and we got to talking, and she said, well, you should have a souvenir from being up here. She said, I know a place, a really nice guy to go and meet, and he will give you or you can buy something from him, namely a caribou jaw sled, of which this man makes many of. I said, fine. So after church, he took me over to Harry's house and introduced me to him and said that Harry works at NARL and that if you move up here for a while, you'll certainly see him. And he's a great carver and all this and that. So we sat there for, I don't know, half hour, an hour, and talked about what I was doing and what Harry does. And so I bought a caribou jaw sled from him, and that was enough to convince me that here was a pretty knowledgeable man and he knew a lot about animals. He'd asked me what I would be working with, and I said, if I come back, I'll be working with Arctic marmots. And he said he knew some things about that and he would try to help me, so on and so forth. So I marked that down as, if I do come here, I've certainly got to get in touch with this man. That's my first meeting with Harry.
Okay. And so if when you tell other people about him, or when you tell your grandchildren about him, what would you tell them about him?
I mean, a real quick summary of...
What was important about his life for other people to know about, or about him as a person?
I think in a few sentences, or maybe not too few sentences, the way I regard Harry is is essentially as a very, very smart man who is very modest also, and had a tremendous amount of knowledge about the animals and the environment in his area. And he was able to explain it to somebody in a very clear way. He was very patient about answering questions. He wanted you to learn, and he was always available to help. If he were in the Western society more, let's suppose he lived in Pennsylvania. If he was living in Pennsylvania and grew up there, he would probably be the head of a zoology department. He would be a great scientist of some kind, okay? Or the dean of a college of science, or something like that. I mean, he's a really gifted sort of guy. And he has done a whole lot more for the people, Eskimo people, than most of them realize. And I tried to summarize that at his funeral in talking about how his comments have basically directed the North Slope Burroughs Bowhead Whale Research Program, through which we've spent millions of dollars over the past 15 years. But most of it has been directed at documenting what he said. So that's basically what I would say. He's a fine man, good teacher, and a whole lot more people owe things to him than realize. The good quota, that harvest quota that people have nowadays, is due as much to him as anyone, but very few people realize it.
Are there any particular experiences that or come to mind that are ones you like to share about Harry?
Well, I think there's a whole lot. There's a whole lot of them. But let me just give you a couple of examples. When I first got started here and came to Narl on sabbatical leave from the University of Maryland in the summer of 1977 with my family, and I subsequently stayed for 2 years. But when I came here to study this Arctic marmot, which is a groundhog-like animal for the U.S. Navy, I needed lots of help trying to figure out where do you get the animals. Once you get them, how do you take care of them? And I also needed some help in designing some artificial dens or nest boxes for these animals, because I wanted them to hibernate outside the ARF here at Narl. And I knew more or less what I wanted to build, but I'm not a very good builder. So I got referred to Harry, who was the chief carpenter, I guess you would say, at Narl. And I went over, I'll never forget this, and I went over to the carpentry shop in 77 or so and said, "Harry, you've helped me a lot on how to get marmots and all this and that, and now I need to house them in these special enclosures that will allow them to hibernate over the winter, but I need to be able to put temperature probes into the den and all this and that." And I said, "This is about what I want to do. How can I build this thing?" Well, he said, "You draw a rough drawing, bring it over here, and I'll talk to you about it." So I made a very rough drawing, went over and talked to him about it, and we sat and talked about it until he understood what I wanted, because I can't draw very well. And he said, "Okay, I understand what you want. You come back in a day or two or 3 days or whatever it was, and I'll have this thing for you to look at." And I came back in 2 or 3 days, and he had a box made that was like 4 feet by 4 feet by 4 feet, and inside it was some insulation 6 inches or so, and then another smaller box inside, and a tunnel leading out through it, and little trap doors that I could get in and out of it, and so on. Well, it was a real piece of work. I said, Harry, this is exactly what I need, and it wasn't exactly as I explained it to you. He knew more about what I wanted than what I told him. So then he made three or four of these things for me, and I was then able to study the behavior of this animal for the next couple of years under more or less normal conditions. So that clued me in right away that this guy is really a talented man. Not only his brain's really good, but his hands are real good. He's very... Then, of course, I found out about all his carving and stuff like that. It was easy to see how he could be such a good carver, because he was such a good carpenter, and obviously he was a good carpenter because he was a good carver. So that's just one little story. There's lots more.
Well, as many as you want to tell, or ones that you think I should know or other people should know for this project, which is in some way trying to tell about his life. And he told me his own little bits of stories. It's not like I sat down and said, tell me about your life, when were you born, blah, blah, blah. So I don't quite know how it's all going to piece together. But
all right, let me tell you what I think is the biggest impact that probably that a single person around here has had, native or non-native, on resolving the controversy with the International Whaling Commission and the federal government and the local people. That controversy that was buzzing in the late 70s about how many bowhead whales are there. Let me explain to you why I think he's the single person most responsible for having resolved that problem without anybody getting killed, and in a manner that has made almost everyone satisfied and has resulted in a really good harvest quota. In 1981 or thereabouts, when I came back here from having spent... In 1979, I left here from being a visiting scientist, went back to the University of Maryland, spent 2 years, and then came back through the efforts of Ray Dronenberg and the then mayor, Jake Adams, to help establish the borough science program. And the biggest problem that we faced was what to do about the controversy over how many bowhead whales there are. In 1981, the federal government had been counting whales for a couple of years, but their budget had been severely cut, and they were trying to get out of the business of counting whales. So the AEWC took it over for a year, and then eventually it fell to the borough. But when we were sitting around trying to figure out what are we going to do, we could go on and imitate what the National Marine Fisheries Service was doing, that is having people stand out at the edge of the ice of the lead with a pair of binoculars and try to count whales that go by. We could do that, and in fact that's what we started out doing. But I had had many, many conversations with Harry Brower in the 2 years that I was here, 77 through 79, about whales, about marmots. I used to go down and talk to him, like, since I had been in school for most of my life, it seems like, I was used to going and talking to professors and teachers, and I was also used to going to the library. Well, as you know, at that time there was no library in Barrow. So I would go and talk to Harry in the evenings about all sorts of things, not only whales and marmots and so on, but the ice and God knows what, and he always seemed interested in talking. And sometimes my wife would go with me. We'd go down and just talk to the guy. So that when I came back in 1981 and got this thing sort of dumped on me, you know, how are we going to get this whale number straightened out? There was no library to go to, which is the normal thing a scientist does, is you go to the library and get all that's known, and then you figure out your path. There was no library at that time here, and even if there would have been a library, the number of bowhead whale pieces of information would have been next to nothing. Okay. So, remembering back to what Harry had told me about these whales, I said, maybe we better really start checking with Harry. I went and talked to him a number of times about, we're trying to count these animals, what do you recommend? What are some of the wrong things that are going on and so on? And he very carefully pointed out the following things. Number one, he said, there's a whole lot more whales than you scientists think there are. And at that time, it was thought there were about 2,000. Number two, he said, these whales do not all swim up the open water of the lead like a lot of you scientists think they do. And by you scientists, he wasn't putting me down. He was just saying scientists in general. And number three, he said, these whales aren't afraid of ice like other whales, gray whales, and like people are. He said, these whales are not afraid of ice. And the fourth thing he said is that these whales travel when they come past Point Barrow on a wide front. They're not confined to the lead. There's a lot of them out there under the broken ice. So this thing about a passing on a wide front was very important. And then the fifth thing he said was that there are that the whales can break ice. Not only are they not afraid of ice like us, but they can break through ice to breathe. And then probably the sixth thing he said was that from what he knew from talking to people at St. Lawrence Island, not all the bowheads come up here anyway. So not only are you not counting the ones that come past here right, there are other ones that you don't even think about counting. Now, he didn't sit there and go through these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. But this is what I got from talking to him over many, many times. And we sat and talked about each one of these things a number of times. Not like I was quizzing him or anything, but over a period of, you know, quite months and so on, sitting and talking about these things. So, there I had the idea from him that, let me tell you one of the, just as an example, he said, you know, just let me give you an example, he said, of how I know that they pass on a wide front and that they're underneath the ice and all this and that. He said that when we're out hunting in the spring in the lead in a boat and we get tired of paddling, if we're near the other side of the lead, namely where the ice is, the floating ice, he said, sometimes we will just go over to the ice, the floating ice, and hang on and take a break. Everybody rests. But he says, when we're doing that, he said, you can hear whales blowing out in, that is, further offshore out in this broken ice. We're on the edge of the broken ice, and out there you can hear the whales blowing. So he said, I know they're out there. In fact, he said, we all know they're out there. You guys are the only ones that don't know that. And about breaking ice, he then told me about the whales that he'd seen break up through a foot of ice or through 6 inches of ice or through 4 inches of ice. They gave me lots and lots of examples of breaking through ice. And he said that whales don't need an opening in the ice that's 100 yards long to come up and breathe. They can come up in a very small hole that's maybe only 2 feet in diameter, because they only need to get their blowhole out of the water. And if that's not good enough, they'll actually break the ice, especially if it's thin. So this is great. I said, all right, this is all good stuff. And somewhere along the line, he also told me that these whales make a lot of noise. They talk, you can hear them. If you put the paddle in the water and put the paddle near your ear, he said you can hear the noise they make. And I just didn't think a whole lot about that at the time. Anyway, soon after a lot of this had happened, but before we really formulated what we were going to do, I was in Fairbanks at a meeting of the borough's science advisory committee. And during a lunch break at the, what's the name of that hotel down there? It's now called Wedge Westward. What's the name of that place? I'll never forget it, but we were sitting in a restaurant with a couple of people on the science advisory committee, one of whom is Dr. Bill Ellison. And I had met Bill when I was up here in the 70s. He's a Navy physicist and worked on underwater problems, submarines and torpedoes and this kind of stuff, acoustics. And he had then since left the Navy, but nevertheless, he had agreed to serve on our science advisory committee. And there was another guy, I think it was Dr. Bill Cummings, I think was there at the same time too. And I was explaining to those guys, since they were both acousticians, some of the problems we were having with trying to figure out how to count these whales that Harry says are out there under the ice. I'll never forget, it was just like in a movie. In a movie, what happens is somebody real quick grabs up a pencil and starts drawing on the tablecloth. Or they get a napkin and start drawing on the napkin. Well, in this version of the movie, Dr. Ellison reached over and grabbed a napkin out of the napkin holder and started drawing on it and said, Tom, here's how you find the whales that Harry says are under the ice. You put hydrophones along the edge of the ice where the whale counters are standing, and you listen to the whales that are out there, and if you have three hydrophones, you can localize them and so on. You know part of that story. I said, wow, this is really interesting. I said, this must be awfully hard to do. He says, no problem at all. He said, we do it in the Navy all the time, localizing Russian submarines and torpedoes and so on. Anything makes noise. He says, no problem. So that was how we then got the acoustics thing really into the system. Harry pointed the direction, and this guy essentially gave us the way to go in that direction. So from that, then we said, okay, let's design the study year after year to basically determine whether these things that Harry said are true. It wasn't quite that deliberate, but it's the way it worked out. And over the years, that's what we've done, is to spend millions and millions over 15 or more years documenting the movement of these animals. But the experimental design was set up to more or less determine what Harry was saying, whether it was true or not. And that's sort of that. Now, that story, which, you know, took all these years to sort of play out. And then I'd go back and check with Harry lots and lots of times. So over the many years that I was in Barrow while he was here, you know, we had probably hundreds of conversations. And, he would know how we're doing, tell him how we're doing, all this and that. And one of the things about them whales breaking through ice, this idea of them just coming up under a thin pan of ice of, say, 4 to 6 inches and cracking it with their blowhole, you know, not coming up with their jaw and breaking it like a locomotive or something like that, but just breaking it with their blowhole and cracking the ice, similar to what a BB does to a window. If you ever shot a little BB or a little rocket, a window, it makes a tiny hole and then cracks radiate out from it, or your windshield around Barrow. And he said, you people need to go out on the thin ice and find these. They're out there. And somewhere along the line, Craig and some other kids went out and actually found these things and then photographed them and wrote them up. And these, as it turned out, are things that people had been seeing from airplanes for years and didn't quite know what they were. And it's a place where the whale comes up under the ice and with its blowhole just barely cracks the ice, breathes and goes on without ever, let's say, breaking the ice, other than just this little crack. And as time went on, and we eventually, we could never get into the Soviet Union to determine whether or not some whales from St. Lawrence Island were going over there or not. And in the meantime, I had talked to lots of people from St. Lawrence Island, and they said, oh yes, Harry's right, that's right, a lot of whales go over there and don't go to Point Barrow. And of course, people from there had told him that, and then he told us. Well, anyway, in 1989 and so on, and since then, we've been able to get over there and had some native people over there helping us, and sure enough, there are a lot of bowheads that show up over there in the spring and summertime that, near as we can tell, never come here. But Russian scientists know that. Russian native people know that. The only people who didn't know it were Western scientists. But people now know. So that over the years, as the count became more reliable here, that is, the acoustics worked better, the visual worked better, and so on and so on, through the efforts of people like Craig George and Chris Clark and Geoff Carroll and others. Finally, the estimate got up to the point of where it is now, which is 8,000. And now people have a very good harvest quota. And although lots of people from St. Lawrence Island to Barter Island benefit from all this, very few of them understand where the driving or the little ideas came from. Some of them think that the borough somehow magically did all this, or that the federal government did it, or whatever. But on almost every occasion I get, I always try to point the finger to where it belongs. And the most One of the other most vivid memories I have about Harry was at his funeral, where I was able to say a few words. And that's the thing I tried to point out at his funeral, was just how many people in the audience owed so much to this guy, who had no idea that they owed him anything. So that, if there's like an unsung hero, so to speak, in the resolving of this great controversy between IWC, federal government, AWC, and so on. I mean, Harry's the guy who was in behind the scenes, who had the biggest impact of any single person. And I've every speech that I've ever given on this subject, I give him credit, and I've got his picture right there. Mm-hmm. So, to me, this is even hard for me to talk about. Just like talking at his funeral was real hard for me to talk. I mean, I've had in my life so many teachers, it seems like. I can count the number of good teachers I've ever had on one hand. It'd take many hands to count the number of less than good teachers. But he's one of the best teachers that I've ever had. And I think it's important that people try to give him the recognition that's due. And the idea of you doing this, your master's degree on this, I think is real good, because not only are you going to tell a true tale, but it's a tale that needs telling by a guy who's so modest that he'd never blow his own horn. He never even picked up his own horn, let alone blow it. As I told you, the idea of traditional knowledge, and you work in oral history and all that, you know that traditional knowledge is something that gets lots of lip service by governmental agencies, industry, you name it. But when it comes right down to it, it's generally regarded as interesting, but, who knows. And the biggest example that I know of of traditional knowledge have been fully verified in scientific investigation is this bowhead thing. And as I told you, there's a lady who's doing her doctoral work in England, Mary Corr, whose topic is the use of traditional knowledge to verify, or that has been verified through scientific means or something to that effect. So part of her work is to use this as an example. Because over the years, it seems to me, from having met with oil company and MMS and NIMS and all these guys hundreds of times, is that they do talk about traditional knowledge, but it's generally only taught, and it's usually ignored. And part of it is because there's no really good, or not very many really good written down examples of where it's been shown to be absolutely true. And I think what you're doing through trying to verify what Harry's done, great. What this other lady's going to do through documenting this particular instance and maybe some others will provide us with at least two documents, your thesis and this other lady's thesis, which will give us examples to cite as well. The traditional knowledge held by Native people, just as the traditional knowledge of non-Native people, it's not all 100% correct, and nobody should say that. But the traditional knowledge of whatever group you're talking about probably has many components that are true. Some of them are rather mythical, maybe, but some of them are quite true. It's just that not enough of them have been, you know, verified. Nobody's spent the effort. And here now we're going to have a few instances that are going to be verified. Does that help you?
Yeah.
That may be more than you wanted on that one instance, but...
Well, no, it's not, because, I mean, he, in my conversations with him, he told me how you couldn't have done all the census work if it hadn't been for him, and he's the one that kind of got the whaling captains to agree to let you do your work.
Oh my God, that's another
thing. And that's,
thing.
You know, you say he was humble and he didn't say that. Well, he did, but, I mean, yeah, he didn't toot his own horn about it.
Yeah, he would never go to a meeting and say something like that. I used to ask him to come to meetings and say these things. And he'd say, oh, yeah, I'll see you. See you there. Wouldn't show up. Okay. But you brought up another thing that I have to mention. My God, I almost forgot. And this is a really... This is a true and a very interesting tale. When we first started collecting specimens from bowhead whales, now you've been out to enough whales to know, and when you go out on the ice, go out to the whaling, where the whales landed, and start poking around, saying, can I have this eyeball, can I have this, that, or the other thing. Nowadays, there's nothing to it. Okay. But let's go back a few years to the late 70s, and in fact 1978 to be exact. Let's see, it was what was it, 78? I think it was 78. Anyway, in the spring of 78 was the first time that any of us around here went out to collect specimens. And the people that were doing this were Mike Filo, who you probably remember, and myself. And we had gotten some money from the Bureau of Land Management to study pieces of the bowhead whale type thing, because it was part of a big push by BLM. There was no MMS then, it was BLM, to get more information about the bowhead. And one of the things was, how does this animal work, kind of? We said, well, we'll go and get some, since we're veterinarians, we'll go and collect some specimens and get them studies and so on, tell you a little bit about how this animal works. So we got some money from BLM to do this. And of course, we then had to go out and get the specimen material. Well, you know, I was kind of emboldened, you might say, because I knew one of the critical people, Harry Brower. Okay, I knew Harry reasonably well. And he said that, yes, he would help. And as luck would have it, I got to meet Bill Colyock. My wife had been teaching his son. We met him on a vacation heading towards Skagway and the Yukon-Whitehorse White Pass Railroad. So we met Bill and his wife and kids on that trip, and as luck would have it, I got to know Bill real well, and he was very nice. And in the spring of 78, when it first came time to charge out there and try to get specimens, just to back up a minute, one of the earlier guys who used to go out and collect some specimen materials had sort of gotten in some hot water from people around here. It's Dr. Durham, Lloyd Durham. And there was some hostility as to, you know, actually going out there and who are you, what are you doing out here, this kind of stuff. I knew that was going to happen. But as luck would have it, the very first whale that got caught in the spring of 78 was by Bill Colyock. And when Mike Philo and I got out there, Bill said, "What do you want? You can have anything you want." It was great. So we got noticed by some people out there, other whaling captains and so on, in a friendly atmosphere. It wasn't too long after that that a whale got caught, or several other whales got caught, and we got more or less did all right. And then a whale got caught by George Mowak. And that was as long before George was the mayor. George was a young man who was not all that enthused about helping scientists, shall we say. And George caught this whale and drug it up on the ice in the same, about the same place as I think it was. And so Mike and I pulled up out there and with our box and all this, and I said, "Oh my gosh, how are we gonna get these specimens?" So I went over to Harry and Arnold Sr., our senior, were there. And George was real cool to me, okay, about getting an eyeball and this kind of stuff. He didn't tell me to get lost or anything, but it was like kind of cool. So I went over to see Harry, who was standing nearby. I said, "Harry, my gosh," I said, "we really need to get a couple specimens out of this whale. Can you please help me get something?" He said, "Tom, you wait right here. And I can see it as clear as I see you sitting there." He said, "Tom, you stay right there." And he and Arnold walked away a little bit, and they just motioned to George like this. And so George Mowak walked over to these guys. And Harry started going like this to him, shaking his finger to him and talking to him. And George's head was going down like this. And this guy was going like this to him, shaking his finger at him. And Harry was talking to him. And a little while later, Harry motioned to me. He said, "Come here." And I walked over. And he said, "George has something to say to you." George said, "Tom, anything you want, you can have." And ever since then, George Mowak has been very, very helpful, as you well know, being the mayor. I mean, he went on to be the mayor and all this and that. George has been very, very helpful. And Harry, needless to say, and Arnold and other guys like that continued to be helpful. But that was a real ice-breaking thing right there, was these two real senior guys, Arnold and Harry, talking to a young man who was probably not that interested in cooperating with scientists, explaining to him that these people are only trying to help, and let's cooperate with them. And from that simple little exercise out there, we've had excellent cooperation ever since. And it was one of these things that one of the most senior hunters, Harry Brower, was able to, in public, you might say, right out there, give his blessing to these couple of young scientific guys. And that was like sprinkling holy water on us, you know. Not everybody instantly became our friends, but there was very little problem in collecting specimens. And as the years went by, you know, working for the borough and so on, everybody understood, or most people have understood. But that was one of the most significant events in the time that I've known Harry, and I almost forgot to tell you.
Well, I'm sure in 25 years or more of knowing him, it'd be hard to pull out...
20, however long it was.
Pull out specific events. But, I mean, some people have, you know, their favorite story or a particular memory that really shows who the person was.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that's kind of what I was trying to get at. So I don't know if you have other ones.
Well, there's lots of other stories, but let me tell you one about a bowhead whale and a baby bowhead. And I asked him on different occasions about how do young whales, little baby whales, get through all this ice and this, that, and the other thing. And he told me about the behavior of mama whales with a baby, and how they would, if there was a big piece of ice, a long stretch of ice in front of them, that the mama would leave the baby in the open water, in the little polynya or whatever it was, and go on under the ice and be gone for a while, and then she would come back, and then they would both go down. And of course he surmised that the mama went through and determined that it was close enough to the next hole that the baby could make it. And that was very interesting, and it makes a lot of sense. But then he told me another thing about an instance where either something went wrong or what, he didn't know, but it was where he was, I don't know whether he was in a boat or on the edge of the ice or what, I forget, but he told me about this big wave that was suddenly coming towards them. Like if you take your hand and run it through the water in a tub or something like that, like a wave builds up in front of your hand. And he said he saw this like wall of water coming at him, several feet high. And then all of a sudden out of this burst a baby whale crossways. And it was in its mother's mouth, or in a big whale's mouth, mother presumably. So anyway, what he told me happened was that here, as the mama swimming with the baby in its mouth, and the baby was crossways in the mouth, you know, was swimming, and it was getting ready to surface while it was pushing all this water up ahead of it, making this sort of wave. It wasn't anything magical or anything. But the thing that I found real interesting was that the mama had the baby in her mouth, and, you know, was this an instance where the mama had just swam a great distance too much for the baby, or the baby was in trouble and she grabbed him, or what? I don't know. But I've heard this from, I think, at least one other person of this type of a scene. Another thing that I want to mention about Harry is that not only was he very nice over the years to me for reasons I didn't always understand, but he was very nice to my wife. And Marnie used to go with me lots of times to listen. And of course Marnie taught all of Harry's grandkids, particularly, you know, the ones that used to stay in the house, little, what was her name, Audrey, who's now all grown up. And anyway, so, and over the years, Harry made things, you know, as he was such a good carver, and he knew things that I wanted to get Marnie for instance, little dolphin-like things carved out of ivory. And he would, every once in a while, like before Christmas, sometimes he would call and say, Tom, I got something really good down here for you. Why don't you come down and take a look at it? And it would be one of these, although he may have made a whole lot of dolphins, there was one that was special colored or, you know, something or other. He'd say, I was saving this for you. Maybe you want to get it for Marnie. And, you know, I, of course, would get those things. And the ones that like this are, you know, truly extraordinary things which Marnie wears and, you know, treasures a lot. And he carved a couple of things especially for me over the years, like a big whale and a marmot and things like this that, you know, we did not request him to do. And I mean, the guy, I don't know, I can't, it's hard for me to say some of these things. He really was a nice guy, and I think he knew that we were really trying to help. Marnie as a teacher and me as this scientist guy. And I think he was trying to say, I appreciate what you all are doing type stuff, you know. Not that any of us are heroes or anything, but... And I think he did this for other people too. He's just a really nice guy. But if there's a bottom line to the whole thing, it's clearly that there's an awful lot of people who have things good now, bowhead whale-wise, who owe a lot more to him than they ever realize. And that's one of the things sometimes that's made me, kind of got me a little upset sometimes. I don't think the local community has given him enough recognition. And part of it, when I've asked, well, some of them say, well, hell, we all know that. You know, we all know that. But the plain fact is that when scientific people were struggling to find out, you know, what do we do? How do we address this problem here? He sat down and explained it. Okay. And maybe if I'd have gone to some other people, they'd have sat down and explained it too. I don't know. Oh, and another thing. Oh, gee, my Christmas.
Wait a minute.